Mishlei, Proverbs, the words of Shlomo HaMelech. We're up to chapter 19. We're going to start with Pasuk 16, Tezayin. I'm not sure if we did it last week or not, but always worthwhile to go over it again. Shomer Mitzvah, Shomer Nafsho. Someone who is Shomer Mitzvah is Shomer his soul. I have a sneaking suspicion we did this last week, but let's talk about it in different ways. Someone who is Shomer the Mitzvot is going to be Shomer his soul. I've said many a time that the word Shomer doesn't just mean to guard or to observe, but it means to cherish, to pine for, to yearn for, being Shomer Shabbos. What does it mean to be Shomer Shabbos? You can't wait for Shabbos. It's based on Yaakov Avinu. This is sort of the Hasidish go-to for the word Shomer. And Yaakov Avinu hears Yosef's dream, gets all upset when he says, Aviv Shamar Sadavar. Yaakov yearns, Rashi says there. He looked forward to the day. Masa Yavo, something like that. When's it going to happen? Yosef Umitzap and Masa Yavo, something like that. When is it that Yosef is going to take power? So here also the word Shomer doesn't simply mean to observe. He does, someone who observes the mitzvos will guard his soul. But what it means rather is someone who values, someone who cherishes, right, the word Shomer means to protect, to guard. What do you do when you're protecting? You're valuing something. You don't protect something unless you guard it, unless you value it. You cherish it. So those who cherish the mitzvot, those who value the mitzvot, are valuing their soul. Bozed rachav, however, yamos. Those who disgrace its ways, so then, yamos, they will die. What exactly? I mean, we definitely did this last week. But I wanted to give a different angle on it because last week I did a quasi-chazara on a bunch of books, a quasi-review on a bunch of books, not because I was actually meaning to, although I should, but because someone gave me an Amazon gift card. And when someone gives me an Amazon gift card, I take that as an opportunity to get things I wouldn't normally get. So now I have a list of all these books that I like to quote, and I have a bunch of them. But there are still about 15 that I don't have, and last week someone gave me a gift card, and I was able to get 8 more. I'm making a dent into them. So anyway, it was like $8 each when you buy them used. So I was very happy. Ricky's like, that's what you want to spend your money on? I said, yes, it is what I want to spend money on. I would like to have those books. I only take the ones that I quote all the time. I literally quote these books all the time, so it's good to have them. The problem is that I've quoted them recently, so now that I have them, I can't even use them because, I can't quote them again because I just quoted them. I can use different parts of it. But either way, the point is that one of those books is a book that I haven't quoted in a while called The Behavioral Code. The Behavioral Code is a book that came out last year or the year before, and it talks about whether or not, or to what extent, the laws that we have on the books actually dictate better behavior. And it talks, it's connected to Daniel Pink's book called Drive, that to the extent that you legislate good behavior, you're actually running the risk of restricting a person's good behavior. Because the more that you obligate a person to do X, Y, and Z, the less they'll actually want to do X, Y, and Z. So when I look at this pasuk, and it says, Shomer mitzvah, shomer nafsho. What does it mean to be shomer? There's a big difference as to whether we translate the word shomer as observe, those who keep the commandments versus those who cherish the commandments. So for instance, Daniel Pink's book, Drive, he talks about how to ruin a newly graduated, student, and how to ruin their passion. You know how to ruin their passion? Give them a salary. Because all of a sudden, instead of doing what they love to do because they love to do it, they'll do what they're doing because getting paid to do it. And then whereas they came out of college, out of their master's program, out of graduate school, as this idealistic, driven, person in pursuit of some kind of greater purpose, whether that's engineering, or that's medical school, or that's a defense lawyer, they come out with this sort of ambition as a young person. All of a sudden, every 2 weeks they're getting a paycheck. And every 2 weeks they realize, in order to get that paycheck, I have to work for 2 weeks. And they no longer see their job as a passion, they see it more as a medium to get their paycheck. It's a very dangerous, slippery slope, as they say, when you give people a preemptive incentive. It's unclear what the better option is. I can see you in here, you turn, you look good. I don't know if you can hear me, but the point is that better would be to foster that passion by giving them projects that are not tied to their salary. I want to say that Ron Friedman talks about this also in his book, Decoding Greatness. I'm not sure. It might have been a different book. The point is that when you give people pockets of time where they're just allowed to, do passion projects, even if the rest of the time they're doing, the work that you need them to get done, so then that passion is still maintained. You know what I'm saying? So here when I read this, a shomer mitzvah, shomer nafsho, it doesn't just mean that they're observing the mitzvahs and thereby Hashem will reward them by giving them their life. What it means is shomer mitzvah, if you cherish the mitzvahs, not that you're doing so in order to cherish your life, in order to procure your life, but you're doing so because you love the mitzvahs, so then that will ultimately be shomer nafsho. And not because Hashem is going to reward you, but because you will become a person of value, a person of purpose. And maybe that's what it means, shomer mitzvah, shomer nafsho. Not just that you're observing the mitzvahs, but that you are cherishing them, you're valuing them. They are still a passion of yours. So then shomer nafsho, the Rabbein Yonah explains, ha-chafetz lishmer nafsho yishmer mitzvos, that's more transactional, the way that he says it. But then I believe he says other ways. He talks more about the chote. Okay, I think this is going to have to be my own drasha. Rashi, you could interpret Rashi a little like that, but not really. On the other hand, that's part of it. Bozed Rachav doesn't mean, but what does bozed mean? He scorns the way of the Torah, or scorns the proper way that he should act. It doesn't just mean that he's not keeping the Torah. It doesn't just mean that he is transgressing the Torah. It means that he's scorning the Torah. He has a disgust for the Torah. He has a begrudging fulfillment, maybe, of the Torah. That's bozed rachav yamus. Because someone who looks degradatingly to the Torah, that they look at it as if it's something that they don't want to do. So then yamus, not because literally they'll die. I think we said this last week from somebody. Not literally yamus, but yamus in terms of who they are. There'll be a person who's alive, but a person who's not dead, but they won't be alive. Where did we see this last week? Yeah, the Malbim says misas hanefesh. It means that somebody who is going to die spiritually. Yeah. We definitely did it last week from the Malbim. We talked about it. But okay, so that's another way to look at it. I could go in different directions also, but not for now. Okay. So that is a chazara of Pasuk Zayin, or maybe an extension of what we did last week. Pasuk Yud Zayin. There are a lot of different ways to understand this pasuk. Malvei Hashem Chonein Dal. Malvei Hashem Chonein Dal. Those who are Chonein Dal, they're gracious to the poor, so then they are Malvei Hashem. Now, that could either mean that they are giving to Hashem, or that Hashem is giving to them. As they hear. Yeah, one who is gracious to the poor is lending to Hashem. I think Rashi says it otherwise. Kishayechla v'yatelamos. When a person is getting sick and is going to die, tidkaso malitza alav, then his righteousness will speak on his behalf, like a Melech Yehoshua we talked about on Shabbos. L'sinei midas hadin lomar ha'ani ha'isa nasho. There was a poor person that needed help, and this person helped it. I too will give him back his soul. So it's not 100% clear how Rashi understands the words Malvei Hashem, but it could be in the sense that Hashem will sustain him, that Hashem will support him. Malvei typically means to lend to. So it doesn't mean Malvei Hashem. Hashem will lend to the Chonein Dal? Or does it mean that those who are chonein dal, those who give to the poor, are themselves malvei Hashem. So what would that mean? It's a beautiful explanation that I saw in a different Tanakh, but I have to find it now. It's either the Ralbag or the Mitzudas Sion. Let me find it, hold on. Is it a Tzavid? Yeah, it's the Ralbag. For those who have it, it's the very end of the Ralbag on the top left of Resh Tesvav in the brown sefer that we have. So the Ralbag says like this: Malve Hashem, hine mishehu chonein dal, the person who gives to the poor, ki'ilu malve Hashem yisbara. It's as if he is lending something to Hashem. How is the person who gives to the poor lending to Hashem?
He's getting it spiritually.
Well, I'm giving something to Hashem when I take care of a poor person?
No, you're saying giving that to the poor, but you're getting something spiritually in your mind.
Well, I'm giving something, for sure. But how am I lending something to Hashem when I take care of a poor person? Says a rabbi, a beautiful idea. You are lending to Hashem, ma'ashitim la'ani, ki al Hashem yisbarach la'aspil kol chayraton. Who has to take care of everybody? Hashem does. And if you say, don't worry, Hashem, I got this one. So then Hashem owes you. Right? You're lending Hashem. Hashem, I'm giving you a break. You don't have to take care of this guy. I got him. With the stuff that you gave me, Hashem, I'll give some of mine to him. And now Hashem says, great, I don't have to come up with money from somewhere else for this guy. I don't have to find him a quick bite to eat from somewhere. You're going to take care of him. Great. That means I am taking a loan, right, Hashem? Hashem is taking a loan from me when I give tzedakah, because it's money that Hashem would have had to spend that I'm now saving for Hashem. So chonein dal is giving a malveh, is giving a loan to Hashem. U'zeh yishalim lo Hashem yisbarach gmulo. And that's what the end of the pasuk means when it says, u'gmulo yishalim lo, that which is coming to him, what does this mean? Hashem will pay him his reward. Gmulo is a reward, okay. Gomel means, to give... Give what you are deserved. I guess that's a reward. Ugmulo yishalim lo, meaning Hashem is going to pay you back. Because you saved him some money, you saved him some sustenance that he could give to somebody else, now Hashem will make sure that you get what you need in your time of difficulty. And that might be what Rashi is talking about. The other ones that I saw here, not sure. Rav Bachya apparently says that it's more than that, that it's about the fact that Hashem has particular sensitivities towards those who are vulnerable. And if we take care of those who are vulnerable, so then he'll take care of us because of how much we're looking out for those that he loves all the more than others. Okay. Hold on. Yeah. Moving on to Pasuk Yud Ches. 18. This one is a toughie, at least the way the Mepharshim talk about. Yaser bincha ki yesh tikva. You should discipline your child because there is hope. That's a weird phrase. You should discipline your child because there is hope. What does that mean? A simple sense.
Educating for the future.
What does it mean? Because there is hope.
Because you're hoping that he'll be improved. You're trying to guide him.
Right now, he doesn't look too good. So you'll think to yourself, what's the point? Why do I have to discipline him? He's a lost cause. Says Hashem, no. Yaser bincha ki yesh tikva. You should still discipline that child because there's a chance. There's a beautiful explanation from Rav Sarutzkin on the phrasing of the Gemara in Sanhedrin where it talks about the ben sorer umore. Maybe I've talked about this before. I should have, if I haven't. The ben sorer umore. Who's the ben sorer umore? Ben sorer umore. The wayward son, the rebellious son, the one who is going off the derech, and the Gemara goes through very specific things in order to consider a child a ben sorer umore. It talks about him eating gluttonously and not listening to his parents, etc. And he has to be between a certain age where he's a ben, but he's still obligated in the mitzvot to a certain extent. He's about 12 and a half or something like that. And the Gemara says, really? All these things this guy is going to do, ben sorer umore? Gaon says the truth is, it never happens. Lo haya v'lo nivra. There's never in the history of the world ever been a wayward son. It doesn't exist. The Ben Sora and Mora doesn't exist. So the Gemara says, well then, why are we learning it? Why is it in the Torah? If it's not relevant, if it's not practical, if it's not something we can learn from, so then why are we learning it? So the Gemara famously says in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Drosh v'kavel schar. Learn the halachos and you'll get rewarded for learning them. Yes, they're not practical, but that's what we call Torah lishma. Those in Daf Yomi know this very well. There's some Gemaras that we just look at and we say, this, there's no way this ever happens today. Right, we're doing Yevamos now. So at least for Ashkenazim, we don't allow anyone to do Yevam anymore. So it's not even possible. But besides that, a lot of the other things we're talking about now, the deaf mute and underage girls, it's crazy, crazy scenarios that we can't even imagine in the world we live in. So then, if you learn it, you'll get reward. These are the halachos Hashem put out for different generations when it's more relevant for them than it is maybe for us. And nonetheless, we'll get rewarded for learning. So the Gemara says, but this one never happened to anyone in history. Yibam at least has happened in the past. You know, underage girls being married off, that's happened in the past. But a wayward son that we would kill at 12 and a half years old, never happened. So the Gemara says, so why would you? Drosh v'kavos kar. Still, you learn it, and you'll get rewarded for learning it. So Rav Zalman Sroskin says a very strange Gemara. You're just going to learn something which is entirely theoretical. So Rav Sroskin explains that. I don't know if I've seen this inside. I definitely heard it from someone that I trust a lot. And he said that Rav Sroskin explains that Drosh is not going on the fact that you learn about the Ben Sora Gemara. It's not saying learn the halachos of this theoretical, non-practical issue, and then you'll get rewarded for it. But what it means is Drosh. What we just said. Learn and make sure that you really believe and appreciate what we just said. What did we just say? We just said, lo haya v'lo nivra. There will never be a wayward son. If you know that, if you recognize that there is never a wayward son, that there's never a child who's so rebellious, who's so off the derech, who's so, you know, undisciplined that he's lost to you, if you understand there's no such kid, so then, kabbal tzar. So then you'll get a reward. Meaning, doesn't matter how bad a kid is. Doesn't matter how much of a bully he looks like. Doesn't matter how much he's not listening to you or she's not listening to you. Drosh, that you know that this never happens. There's never going to be a kid who's so wayward that you can't help them. So here too, the pasuk says, Yaser bin chach yesh tikva. Never become too demoralized to think that a child is not worth your discipline. Every child is worth discipline. Every child is worth trying to help, even if it looks like they're never improving. Because you never know, by the way, what kinds of seeds you can plant in a child. Despite the fact you don't necessarily get rewarded for it, you don't know what kinds of seeds you're planting. There's interesting stories, and there are a lot of stories about this. I once heard a story about a kid in MTA who went to yeshiva, and He went to yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. He went to Israel after high school, and he has flipped out. And he comes back to MTA. He comes back to the school. I think it was MTA. I don't know why. It doesn't matter. But he comes back, and he's all stark, and he says, what in the world happened to this kid? This kid, his former Rebbe from high school, is like, how in the world did this kid flip out? He was the worst kid. He was so undisciplined. He was so misbehaving. And so the Rebbe goes over to the kid and says, knew what happened, you know? He said, you'll never guess what happened. I was a bad kid in Israel, too. And for a few months, I wasn't doing anything. I stayed in my room. I did whatever I wanted. I went out, you know, on the town, whatever. And then one day, one of the rabbis at the yeshiva just said, I want to learn with you for, you know, a half hour a day. Just give me a half an hour a day. And we learned this book called the Path of the Righteous, the Mesilas Yesharim, the Path of the Just. And I loved it. Just a half hour a day, learning every one day after the other. And ultimately, I saw the benefits, and I saw how I can improve it as a person, how I need to shape up, etc. And that's what happened. That's what started me on my flipping out, as they say. And the Rebbe started to cry. He says, oh, if I would have, you know, the kid figures that, you know, it's his fault. He should have learned that safer. And the kid says, don't worry, Rebbe, it's not your fault. You know, everyone, you know, tries their hardest. And Rebbe says, that's not why I'm crying. I'm not crying because I never learned that safer with you. I'm crying because I did learn that sefer with you. We learned that sefer every single day also. But you never actually, you never took to it. But you never know. Who knows why that kid turned it around? It could be because of those seeds that that Rebbe planted. You think that the kid doesn't benefit from anything that you're teaching him. It's one year and one in the year and then out the other. But the truth is, you never know what kinds of imprints we make on children. Even if it looks like it's not making a dent and not making any impression on them, you never know down the line what kinds of things they remember and what kinds of things will impress on them, even if they don't know. Even if they don't know what the difference is. It's hard for a Rebbe. It's hard for a teacher sometimes, because by the time they get older and they, you know, they get engaged, you don't get the wedding invitation. They don't remember what kind of impression you made on them. But the first grade teacher, the second grade teacher, that are perhaps the most important teachers in a child's life. Always have to remember that by the time they get into high school, the cake is baked. It's not like you can change them that drastically. It's like learning a language. Once you're too late learning a language, it's very hard. You can still do it, but it's very hard to reprogram a person's mind to that extent. So here, Yasser bin Chakish Tikva, always think you can discipline a child. There's always hope. Now, the reason why I introduce this pasuk as saying this is a difficult pasuk is because most of the mefarshim on this pasuk refer to the word yaser as to be referring to some kind of physical discipline, which is not something that we take lightly in America, especially with the sensitivities we have today. But the point is that some will be deterred. Now, they say some will be deterred because why should I physically discipline my child if it's not going to benefit at all? But we can say that it means just in terms of having any discipline, why would we do that? And part of that is the difficulty of the end of the pasuk. V'el hamito al kisa nafshecha. How do you have hamito? Teresa, how do you have that translation? Hamito, the end of pasuk 18. Yeah, the end of 18. His destruction. Yeah, hamito. What the word hamito? What do you see in the word hamito? Mace, death. So that's how all the mafreshim are trying to figure out what does that word mean. And to his death, do not take up your soul. Here in the article, it translates, let your soul not be swayed by his protest. The word hamito means protest. I don't know. You can imagine if it means, right? If here Rashi says, al takeo makas maves. Right, you should discipline your child, but to the extent of death, don't do it. Right, don't hit him so hard that you'll kill him. That's why it's a hard passage to read. V'el hamito al kisan hashacha. Discipline him, but not so harshly. So the Rabbeinu Yonah explains. Don't stop disciplining him just because he's crying. Because you're worried maybe he's going to, or hamito could be, in Rabbeinu Yonah's case, it could mean that protesting concept. That they're so, it's so difficult for them. Difficult for us to read it too. Yeah. Masudas David similarly says, Don't try to discipline him to the extent you're going to kill him. So it's a hard pasuk. It's a difficult pasuk to understand. But in terms of the idea of discipline, in terms of the concept of instilling within our children the proper values, you might think that it's a lost cause. You should never think that. Let's see if the Rabbi says something. I didn't see anything earlier, but let's see. Yeah, same thing as Rabbeinu Yonah. Don't stop just because he cries about it. And but he has an interesting phrase at the end here. Don't stop disciplining him. He tov lo shi kabal hamuster im hahamaya. Better that he receives the discipline with among his protestations. Vasaka and his screaming. Better that he does it like that. Better that he protests being disciplined than not be disciplined at all and be happy about it. kind of an interesting phrase. Sameach im heder kibul hamusar means basically that if you don't discipline him, so then what's going to happen? He's going to think that what he's doing is fine. You can't let them be undisciplined in any way. You can't let them go. You can't let them go without consequence, inconsequentially. They did something wrong. They have to understand. They have to understand their consequences of their actions. And there are a whole different strategies about how to discipline today. As I said before, in terms of the behavioral code, how do we instill the right values while not pushing them away at the same time? There are different strategies of doing that. But at least when you look at this Rabbah, there is somewhat of a gap between doing nothing and hitting your child, right? There's other things in between there that you can do too. So just because you're not hitting them doesn't mean that you're not disciplining them. There are other ways that you can discipline without hitting. Okay. Enough of sort of criticizing previous generations' methodology. Okay. So the next pasuk, another interesting one, which we haven't seen in a while, but is almost at the core of a lot of what Mishlei is about, in that it's about sort of controlling your emotions. Gidal chema nosei onesh. A person with great anger. How do you translate chema? Sarita? 19? Hot-tempered, yeah. Someone with a big, gets very angry. So nosei onesh, he will bear punishment. So this is just on the face of it. What is he bearing punishment for? So if you read the pasuk, it sounds like just the act of becoming angry is itself consequential. Interesting concept. That you can be held liable just for being upset, just for being angry. Not necessarily because he did anything to anyone. Ki'im tatsil v'od tosif. Ki'im tatsil v'od tosif. Because even if ki im tatsil, even if it might have helped for the moment, od tosif, you're going to do it again. This is actually similar to how the Ralbag finished off his commentary. If you leave your problematic behaviors, your child or your own, unchecked, so then it's going to lead to doing it again. Meaning, let's say you get angry at somebody, and it actually works. They stopped doing what they were doing. What are you going to do next time? You're going to get angry again. And then again. And then again. Maybe it's going to work this time like it worked that other time. And then most often it's not going to work. Especially when you're dealing with a different person. Or the same person in a different situation. Or the same person, same situation, but your anger takes form in a different way. So you can never ever justify anger because you never, first of all, even in a transactional way, even if you think that it works this time, it won't work other times. But besides that, as I said before, gidal chema nosei onesh, just the act of getting angry is itself consequential, is itself a problem. Let's see how Rabbeinu Yonah explains it. Even though we said that you should not, you know, refrain from disciplining your child. If you're someone who gets really angry, if you discipline even physically more than is necessary, so says Rabbeinu Yonah, that's going to be a problem also. Just like you would get punished for hitting somebody else, you get punished for disciplining your child. Okay, interesting. Rabbi Yonah explains it differently than the article translation, which is probably, I have to guess, based on Rashi. Oh no, it's not. Rashi says, "Im tavir al chamascha v'tatzel sonacha, if you pass over your anger and you don't give into it." And thereby you save that one for whom you're upset at. Imra isara ba'alo otosif yama yamim v'tova. So if you don't do it and you refrain from hurting them, even though something bad happened, you'll have more life afterwards if you don't get angry about it. And there's a general general advice also, that we often think that a quick fix is going to make it better, and at the end of the day, it's going to be worse. Even if you can discipline a person in the moment, and you think you've accomplished something right now, so then ultimately it's not. It's only going to be a crutch, if you will. I think about this actually quite often when my kids are finding it difficult to do something, not in terms of anger, but in terms of allowing them to fail at something in order that they can learn how to do it. To the extent that it's possible, you should allow your child to continue trying and get it themselves as opposed to telling them how to do it or doing it for them. Because if you continually do the quick fix, it might be true that they'll finish their puzzle quicker or they'll finish their breakfast quicker. But in the end of the day, what you're doing is you're handicapping them for the next time they have to do something along those lines. So you want to make sure that you're always giving them the opportunity to fail and also giving them the opportunity to fix it themselves. It's frustrating as a parent sometimes. They're always balancing values at the same time. But yeah, all else being equal, you should allow your kids to figure it out.
I think when you started, you said it's pretty good job.
Yeah.
First was the nope. Race.
Yeah. So we've talked about this before in terms of what's to be learned from these things. Whenever there's a kriyuk siv, so then often there is some kind of implicit message that we can, or deeper message we can learn from the pasuk. So garal chim anose onesh, I don't know. Garal means like a lottery, or a lot, or something like that. Maybe I don't know. I can't figure out what the other explanation would be with the word garal. But the way that you're supposed to read it is gadal, and that's how most of my parshim read it. I don't know what garal chima would mean. Maybe it means someone who's naturally angry. That would be hard. That would be a hard thing to impose upon a person who's naturally angry. Garal, like your lot in life or something. Garal chima nose onesh doesn't sound like something which is just to give to make someone give someone a punishment because they're an angry person naturally. I don't know. Either way. So different ways of understanding the end of that pasuk. Either by foregoing your anger, you will save them and thereby add days to your life. Or what it means is that even if it works this time, it'll add problems next time. So it's not worth it to even do it this time. Okay, interesting. Let's see. Oh, the Ibn Ezra has a completely different explanation. Let's look at the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra says on Al Tisana Shecha, where he explains as we continue on in the Psukim, this is in the middle of Reish Yud Zayin for those with the Sefer. He has a bunch of Pei Alos there, which means Perish Acher. So the last parish acher there, three lines up on the end of the third line up on the right side. Parish acher, al tisan afshecha mimenu shetachsoch mimenu musar. Do not, al tisan afshecha, don't refrain from giving a musar. Aval, however, the next pasuk, haben shehu gedal chema, the child who is overly angry, not the father. Not the parent who's disciplining gets angry. The child gets angry. Mitzad chamaso hagdola azvehu. If the child is someone who has such a bad temper that you're running a risk of disciplining them by disciplining them, so then yazvehu. So then leave him alone. V'yiyya mekabel onsho kmo nose avono v'yal titzalik v'atalaso. Says Ibn Ezra, it's not worth trying to save that child. If you try to save him this time, you'll try to save him a bunch of other times. I don't know exactly what this means, but so at first sight of this Ibn Ezra, I thought that's what it meant. But then I kept reading and I thought maybe what he means is like this: sometimes the best discipline for a child is to let them be punished. Right? Let's say your child is, let's go extreme so no one gets offended here, hopefully. Let's say your child is does something wrong and is put in jail. And you have to pay a bond to get him out. So, okay, maybe you made a mistake, you get him out. The next time it happens again. So, okay, should I do it again this time? You do it again. So what's going to happen? He's going to do it again. So sometimes the better option is to let them experience the repercussions of their activity. The more that you help them in those situations, the more that you will enable them to continue those situations, to maintain the situation. Now, it's a difficult... Well, it depends what it is. Yeah, it's all situational. I think what the Ibn Ezra is saying here is not the same thing, but it's a similar concept. Allow him to receive a punishment. And don't try to save them from that punishment. Because if you save him one time, you're going to have to save him a bunch of other times. It's not easy, but I had a kind of weird conversation with somebody about a month ago. I'm wary of this guy. He told me he was going to be in shul every week, and it hasn't been since. So I think my instinct was probably accurate. But the guy came to me and he said, Rav, I need help, disciplining my son. I said, what happened? He said, my son stole some kind of thing from a store. Doesn't matter. And I don't know if the store owner called the cops or the father called the cops, but the cops came and he explained the situation and he said to the cops, can you scare my son? Like, discipline him to show him that this is not something to do. Now, the kid is like maybe a teenager, maybe a young teenager. I don't necessarily think that that's the extent that you have to apply this message, but this is sort of this was the father's thinking. Like, scare the kids straight. Give them a punishment so that they'll learn their message, they'll learn the lesson. So I don't think that that would be a beneficial way of going about disciplining a teenager. But there is a certain threshold where maybe someone who's older, not getting their act together, and you're enabling them, so at a certain point it's sort of like you got to go on your own and make them recognize their own abilities. Because as long as you're enabling them and you consistently, whatever it might be, pay for their apartment, get them out of trouble, so the more you do that, the more they're not going to learn their lesson in the real world. So, I mean, it's very situational. I'm not telling anyone to do that. But I think the Ibn Ezra's point here is that there are situations where a child is such a hothead, if you will, a gedal chema, they have such a crazy anger, they need to learn the punishment of that anger. And they need to learn it the hard way in order for the message to get across to them. They say, I think it's a concept in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not sure, but it's certainly a true phenomenon. I believe James Clear talks about it in Atomic Habits, or maybe it's Charles Duhigg in Power of Habits, I guess the book's mixed up, as you can imagine, where you have to hit what's called rock bottom. Right? Sometimes if it's not yet bad enough, they're still hanging on, they can still call up a friend and get out of their issue, so then they're not going to get the message. It's only once you hit rock bottom, you really feel the terribleness of your situation, that's when you feel like you really got to change yourself. So maybe that's what Ibn Ezra is saying here. Yeah, sometimes you got to let a person hit rock bottom for them to realize that they've got to turn it around. Okay, interesting. I did not see that before, but I'm glad I saw it. It's a very interesting read of the Pasuk. Pasuk Chas, Shema Eitza V'Kava Musar. You should listen to counsel, to listen to guidance, and accept Musar. That's very interesting. There are two separate stages of being disciplined. One is being willing to listen. That's the first hurdle. A lot of people aren't willing to be disciplined, not because they don't think they have improvement. They don't think they have room for improvement. They're not willing to be disciplined because they're not willing to listen. And that's stage number one, is to be willing to listen. Katie Murphy talks about, the concept, you're not listening. you know, I think about this fairly often because I'm guilty of it. But she says in the middle of the book that it's not a good idea to listen to things on expedited speed. You know, when I listen to things on my phone or on the internet or whatever, I'll speed it up just because I'm looking for information. If I'm looking for something emotional, so I won't really speed it up. But if I'm looking just for information, so I will speed it up. And she says that affects your ability to hear other people. So I always have to keep myself in check in that sense. But it probably also affects how quickly I speak too. But that's besides the point. But here, your ability to listen is going to affect your ability to accept what other people are saying. There are two stages. My father used to say, although it's not exactly the same thing, my father's basketball coach, he always used to start off his basketball lessons at basketball camp. He used to start off by saying, in my gym, we have two rules. The two rules are, you have to listen, and you have to pay attention. Two different things. One is to just allow the sound to go into your ear, to try, and then pay attention, to try to actually learn something. So here also, Shema Eitza V'Kabel Musar. You have to first listen, and then you can be Mekabel something. You can't be Mekabel if you're not willing to listen. Active listening, as they call it. Why? L'man Techkan B'Achri Techa. Because ultimately you will become wiser for doing so. Now, this word Ba'achri Secha is an interesting word. Because what it implies is that your wisdom won't be immediate. The wisdom won't be immediate. Only Ba'achri Secha, only afterwards. If you look at the Mitzvah Tavid says, Im Chachmata Bereshit Yamecha. If you wisened up in the beginning of your days, so then ultimately you'll be wise later on. Let me see if there's any note here in the art scroll here. If you accept guidance when you're young, it will help you when you're older. Okay, that's not exactly what the Pasuk says. I don't have the Radak in front of me to see how the Radak says it, but the Pasuk says, Techkam b'achri secha. You will become wise in your older, later on. Not that you'll be able to realize it, but you'll become wise. Let's look at the Malbim. We haven't looked at the Malbim today. Ve'etza hi charusa me'ashem k'firis ono. Oh, that's later. Hold on. Okay, interesting. So he says, Eitza guidance is referring to just sort of raw wisdom, and Musar is in terms of understanding consequences. Yeah. That what will ultimately become of who you are. You'll become a person of sort of praise or nobility, ashrecha, right? Nobility. So that's the Malbim explaining that you'll become a person of nobility later on. What I thought was to say that sometimes you listen and you're makabel musar and it's not really that beneficial. You know, sometimes, you know, I read these books and I listen to these books and you always have to be able to willing to filter out what the books are saying because it doesn't always fit with, especially doesn't fit with the Jewish mindset, often doesn't fit with what you believe to be true, just generally in, you know, other things that you've learned. But sometimes you miss. Sometimes you listen, you do what you're supposed to do, you're listening, you're accepting what they're saying, but it doesn't pan out. Right now, that's not something that I want in my life, that's not something that I subscribe to, so it doesn't work. Right? You will become wiser, maybe not right now, but in the end of the day, you'll be wiser through learning different things, through listening to different people, through reading different books, through reading different svarim, learning different ideas, and studying them. So maybe some things won't find them relatable, or you won't find them relevant, or maybe you'll even find them downright to be wrong. But techkan b'achri secha, at the end of the day, you'll be able to learn something from them or something from something, as long as you're willing to learn, right? It's sort of like the cast a wide net mentality, right? Learn as much as you can, so that ultimately, Adam Grant talks about this in Think Again, that you should cast a wide net in terms of your career choices. What do you want to do? Get an internship in this and go learn about that, so that ultimately you'll find the right thing that you're passionate about. So the same thing happens with almost everything. You try to learn as much as you can so that you can sift through and find what's correct. I remember I read a book, Originals. Who wrote Originals? Malcolm Gladwell? I think it was Malcolm Gladwell's Originals. No, it wasn't. Hold on. I don't remember if it was Malcolm Gladwell or not. Either way, so it might have been Adam Grant. What? I think it was Adam Grant also. Either way, so they write so in the book Originals. So part of what I really didn't like about the book is the focus on novelty. That the book is all about how to be unique and creative and add something new and different to the world. Adam Grant, that's what I thought. I read it later on, which I think it was I read it in sort of in tandem with Outliers from Malcolm Gladwell, so I get them confused. Also, both start with an O and are one word. But either way, so Adam Grant talks about an original, and he talks about different companies that were successful. What's the eyeglasses company? Warby Parker, I think it's called. Warby Parker. And how they sort of, they were original, they came up with new ideas, stuff like that. And I thought to myself that I don't think this is a Torah concept. I don't think that we should encourage people to make different novel approaches to life. It might be relevant for commerce. It might be relevant for coming up with new novel ideas and innovations, technologies. Okay, good. But we shouldn't be striving to be different. It almost gives too much of an, emphasizes too much of an importance on being different for the sake of being different. And I don't think that's a value. It's a value to have better things, to improve things, and if that's what innovation is, then fine. But to strive for novelty, I think, is a problem. We shouldn't strive for novelty for the sake of being different. I don't think that's a good value. But there are still kernels in that book that I quoted. I've quoted about the idea of the second-born son, the second-born children with older siblings. Studies show that they're more willing to take risks. And I talked about how that relates to Yetzias Mitzrayim and the killing of the firstborn, that Hashem was telling the Jewish people that they should also kill off the mentality of the firstborn. They shouldn't just do what their parents did, which is what a firstborn represents. But rather, they should be a secondborn. They should be the thirdborn, the siblings that are willing to deviate from what their older siblings do and what their parents want them to do. So in the case of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Jewish people were in Mitzrayim for 200 years. They had to recognize that they needed something different. So there are situations where it's good to be novel, especially when you're in servitude. But generally, novelty, just for the novelty's sake, I think is a problematic outlook on life. So that's an example of this. Tachkan b'achrisecha, you'll learn from different things, from different people, and sometimes it'll work out, and in the end of the day, it'll be a net positive. B'achrisecha, in the end of the day, after all is said and done, you'll have learned a lot from a lot of people. Hopefully you'll filter them out in the proper way. The next pasuk, I feel like we'll have to end on this, and then we'll have to sort of pick it up with this pasuk again next week, because or 2 weeks, because this is a very important pasuk. This is the original man plans and God's last. Rabos machshavos levish. There are many thoughts that go through a person's mind. Tasas Hashem hitakum. That it is in it's up to Hashem what actually will prevail. Hashem meaning man has a lot of ideas. We think we can do a lot of wonderful things, and then Hashem says, actually going to do this instead. There's only one line. I think it's a John Lennon song. Does John Lennon have a song called Beautiful Boy? Or no? I don't know. My dad once played me a song, and I only remember one line from all of his songs ever. And it was, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. That's what it says in life is what happens to you while you're busy making others. No. But that's what, I don't know if it's John Lennon or not, but that's what the line was. And it's the same thing. Rabos machshavos levish. You think you're going to do this. You think tomorrow you'll do this. And all of a sudden something happens. And then life happens. Other things happen where they throw you off your course. And the question is, how do you respond to those things? I heard a tongue-in-cheek explanation or interpretation of this. that this is referring to, this is not true. What I'm about to say is not true. Disclaimer. It is not to be taken seriously. It's interesting to note that the first part of the pasuk says, Lev Ish in the man, right, in the male form, that the man thinks a lot, Asaf Hashem, he sakum, she, right? He is referring to, in the actual understanding of the pasuk, he's referring to the Esa, the guidance of Hashem, or the counsel of Hashem, whatever you want to translate it as, young guy with children, said to me that this is the pasuk, Rabos Machnovas Levish, when you hear a baby crying at night, so the man thinks about getting up. Rabos Machshavos Levish. Oh, should I get up? Should I get up? Should I not get up? Atas Hashem. What does Hashem want? He sucks him. She should get up. That's how they said the pasuk. It's just not to be taken literally, but it's an interesting. Rabos Machshavos Levish. The guy always thinks about what to do, and then he sucks him. She always ends up doing it. But yeah, you should fight against that instinct. But either way, we'll pick up with this pasuk. Hopefully, pasuk Chaf Aleph next 2 weeks from now. What does it mean? Rabos Machshavos Levish. What kinds of thoughts does a man think? And what are the aces of Hashem that will ultimately endure against or in line with those rabos machshavos, with those many thoughts? Maybe we can come up with some songs that we can sing for rabos machshavos, those who know them. Okay, everyone should be well.